Hello and welcome to the Making Passenger Podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Tom.
This week we are sitting down with Phil Ellis, CEO and co-founder of Beryl. In 2019, Beryl launched their innovative bike share systems and delivery services to towns and cities across the UK. Most importantly, to us at least, that also includes Bournemouth.
Phil has helped lead Beryl to become a global product and technology company supplying retail and bike share systems. Here at Passenger, we've been lucky enough to work alongside them for at least a little part of that journey.
Hope you enjoy. Hi, Phil. Thank you very much for joining us today. Appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
Let's start at the beginning. How do you know Tom? How do you know Passenger? Because we've done a little bit of work together, but how did that come about? What's your first and earliest memory of Tom?
Good question. I do actually know this one. So, I first spoke to Tom at the Public Health and Sustainable Cities Conference in Bristol, probably, I don't know, just over a year ago. So we had just launched our bike share system in Bournemouth, which was our first big bike share system. And obviously we were sort of new to the area and new to the local authority. And so it was, yeah, really good. We knew of Tom, we knew of Passenger. Our customers at the BCP Council had you know, told us with great admiration about Passenger.
Oh, that was nice.
And so, yeah, that's why I was pleased to meet Tom and start, yeah, figuring out how we can push things forward in Bournemouth a little bit in this sort of world of mobility.
So it's actually quite interesting because we went to that conference on the basis that we were starting to realise that public transport had this natural overlap with kind of active travel.
Yeah.
And this was a term that I was starting to kind of get my head around, yeah, a year or so ago. It was this kind of idea of walking to a bus stop and then sort of getting on the bus and then walking to your destination and all these kinds of, you know, the interplays between the modes. So we were just like, well, let's go along to this sustainable health, or public health and sustainable transport event. And we were surrounded by brilliant organisations like Beryl, who were kind of, you know, promoting their bike share. And as Phil says, that's exactly how we started to talk and then kind of, you know, obviously start to think about how that kind of last mile might come into play with bikes as well as walking.
Exactly.
Yeah. And there you were, Tom, you already might not remember you. Right. So before I get into anything else, I really want to understand, like, you guys have been doing some really great stuff to enable NHS and other key workers to get around using your infrastructure. And it would be remiss not to start there. You know, what were you guys able to do and how fast were you able to react and get the information out? And also, what sort of uptake are you seeing? Anyone using them?
Oh, I've got some stats somewhere. But yeah.
Oh, we love stats.
Yeah, so what we're able to do is really, really quickly. I think we were the first sort of bike share company, certainly in this country, potentially further afield, to basically turn our system into something that could be used more easily by NHS members of staff. So because it's all built on our technology, so we control everything that runs the bike share system. So that includes the app and all of the back end and the payment gateways and everything like that. And we, for a while, have offered our bike share system as a sort of a corporate membership to different organizations. And mm-hmm. So it works very, very simply for an organization who might want to buy a membership for people who work in that company. So, for example, you just use it at, you know, passengerapp.com or whatever your URL is. And anybody who has that email address gets on a whitelist and they get to use the bike share system for free. So in Bournemouth and Poole, what we're able to do is just blanket, if you have an at nhs.uk email address, sign up to the app, put your email address in, we'll automatically be able to identify if that is a valid NHS email address. And then you just use the bike share system for free. And it took, you know, very little time on our side to be able to do that. But, you know, what was really, really good about this is the nature of the scheme and the nature of our involvement with the local authority means actually, you know, have to be the local authority have actually funded it. So every time somebody is using that bike, it's actually the local authority who are paying for that journey to happen. And we've done everything to maintain it and to enable it. And obviously we've changed some of our operating models to make sure there's always a good supply at the hospitals and things like that. And now we've been able to do a few more extra little things actually. So yesterday we launched a bay, a brand new geofenced bay outside of a GP practice somewhere in Bournemouth. And that basically came through because a GP sent us, I think it was even a tweet, and said, I use these bikes for home visits, but there isn't a bay near the surgery. Can you put one in? And our team were able to get a bay in on the ground, put some signage in on the ground. In the back end, we were able to set up that geofenced area and have a fully serviceable bay open to the public, but also there serving that GP's practice, like within like less than 24 hours.
Wow, that's
so
great.
Yeah, we've been able to do that stuff quite quickly by virtue of the control that we have over the system.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And as you say, you already had some of that functionality, so it was quite quick and easy to roll out.
Exactly.
Wonderful.
So Phil, those bays are pretty lightweight bays, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, so all of the bays that we have in Bournemouth are very light touch. So the minimum that all of our bike share systems and e-bike systems and whatever else systems comes next are built around bays. So we don't do like free floating. People have to park their bike in a bay. But we always want to do it, and that's enforced by geofencing. So the bike knows where it is all the time. And if you've finished the journey in the bay, great. If you've finished your journey outside of the bay, we charge a small convenience fee. And that's fine because some people want that convenience, and indeed some local authorities want people to have that convenience. But we always have some level of physical intervention on the ground, right? So in Bournemouth and Poole, that is at its sort of lowest level, which is paint on the ground. So you'll see green squares painted onto the ground that are geofenced, but that physical intervention provides a visual clue so people in real time know where to park the bike. And there's also some signage, you know, like a bike sign that says this is where you ought to park your bike. You know, that sounds very straightforward, but obviously there's a lot of process ordinarily that is involved in like pinpointing all of those bays and making sure they're in the right location. But being able to do it by geofencing and actually have it enforceable, as in actually have it that you can encourage those behaviours by doing a little convenience fee, means that people are parking in those bays. And it means that somewhere like Bournemouth and Poole, we've got, I think, something like 220 bays across that conurbation and a service area that is, I'm not sure exactly, but it's probably like 40 square miles, something like that. Right. And we're able to get that sort of coverage because, yeah, the bays are so light to touch, but nonetheless do everything they need to control where people are parking. So in terms of bays, that bike share system is, well, actually, to be fair, that bike share system is now the biggest bike share system in the country outside of London. But in terms of bays, it's the biggest by, you know, a long way. And bays are really important. Like the density of where you can pick up and drop off these bikes from is so important. Yeah, and so to really have a network where there's like three or four bikes in every bay or five or six bikes in every bay, you know, if you can get 220 bays like that, you get better ridership than if you had, you know, 50 bays of 20 bikes. And so that, yeah, that's what's important about the bays. And that's how we've been able to do it in Bournemouth.
So, I mean, in terms of how you sort of position a bay, I mean, you talked about how you've managed to place one outside of a GP surgery really quickly. That's brilliant in terms of being able to be responsive to needs. Do you guys have any criteria as to kind of, you know, how close that bay needs to be to other infrastructure, things like bus stops or, you know, train stations, any kind of interchange points, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so we've got transport planners in our team that design the scheme. They design within that local area, where do the bays go? So it'll start with a load of sort of desktop research, fitting in with a load of criteria. And you know, we'll start with thousands of locations across somewhere the size of Bournemouth and Poole, and then whittle that down based on a scoring factor for like the propensity for that bay to get used and for the propensity for that bay to contribute to the transport outcomes that the local authority might have. So yeah, like a big factor, like a big sort of point scorer is things like proximity to, you know, a bus stop or proximity to a train station or a tube station in London. And then there's lots of other measures like proximity to other amenities, shops, leisure facilities, things like that. Obviously, loads of other things, line of sight, visible, covered by CCTV. There's a whole scoring matrix. I think it's got about 25 different scores. And then each score has a 1 to 5 metric. So there's this big matrix that gets built up to take loads of locations, whittle them down to what we think is right in terms of the individual locations and in terms of the overall density of that scheme.
Mm-hmm.
Then we layer on top of that a load of requests that might have been made by the public. So this example of the GP was one where, like, if there's a special request made and we think we can do it, then we'll do it. And then you've got to consider loads of like safety hygiene factors. So the area has got to be sort of big enough for the bays, but not get in the way of like our number one in the hierarchy of person moving in a city being the pedestrian. Like, it's got to not get in the way of pedestrians, and then particularly pedestrians that have special requirements. So, you know, we'll then do a walkthrough of the bays with local visually impaired charities and things like that, and make sure that there's room on the pavement, if it is on a pavement, to make sure wheelchairs can get past and things like that. We'll do a walkthrough with people with white canes to make sure that it's visual for them. Like, there's so much stuff that goes into street design and like tactile flooring and stuff like that you can't just like plonk a bay down. So yeah, then we'll once we've done all the research and implement it, we'll implement it carefully. It is worth saying on bays though, like, my sort of driving aim with all of this and it is basically, yeah, we need to get as many bays as we think is appropriate for the density, but ideally we also want to get them actually on the carriageway. So I mentioned pavement a few times there, but for us, like, we want them in the road and taking mm-hmm. up parking spaces, basically. But that's not always possible for all sorts of reasons. And so that flexibility of the bay is important for us getting the density that we need.
So that's interesting. Just with what's been going on most recently, and it's an interesting point that you've made there about trying to get them on the roads. If we look at what's been announced over the last couple of days, certainly last weekend, and we see that all local authorities, but, you know, thinking more specifically, BCP, so Bournemouth, Christchurch, Poole Council, local to us, have been tasked with putting additional social distancing measures in place and physical infrastructure. So that's widening pavements, creating additional cycle lanes. And this is supposed to help reduce pressure on public transport, which even at, you know, when it's running at full capacity, is only allowed to carry up to 20% of its usual passenger numbers. And so, as part of all of that stuff that's been announced, what do you know about it? How long do you think temporary is? And what sort of infrastructure that is temporary can become permanent? So perhaps some of those spaces that you're talking about.
Yeah. So in terms of like the very, you know, technical and sort of regulatory things around that, we'd have to speak to the transport planners in our team who know. But the thing that's interesting about the recent announcements is it's in a very good way, like, it's put the power in the hands of the local authority. So these journeys that we're enabling are local journeys, you know,
yeah,
0 to maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 miles, something like that. So like
mm-hmm.
being as close to the ground as you can be and figuring out how to enable those is the right way of doing it. So giving the power to the local authorities to do it is the right way of doing it. And I think some of the guidance that's come out from the DfT is basically, I mean, there's lots of measures, but as far as I can make out, it basically says you can do it now and you can do it for 18 months. All the normal stuff around consultation still exists and you still have to do it, but you can sort of do it alongside. And obviously you definitely need to do it if you're going to make it permanent. And obviously that's like our and hopefully lots of people's big hope that these things become permanent, and that will require further funding. But I think the other thing that's really interesting, again, about the bays and about what else might come, the last thing that we as a bike share provider, you know, can allow to happen is that, you know, we create this space for walking and cycling, and then e-scooter trials might be allowed. And the last thing that can happen then is what we've seen in some of the other American European cities, is that space is sort of used up by a load of scooters that are kind of parked there somewhat haphazardly, not in geofenced bays, not with a supporting ground operation. And suddenly your 10-metre bay is shrunk down to a 1-metre filter because there's a load of scooters parked haphazardly. And then we've got the absolute opposite outcome that we need, which is, you know, a really powerful method of sustainable shared transport, turning public opinion away from this industry because it's actually sort of eating into this positive space making activity that's going on right now and going on at pace. So we're really keen to make sure we get that right with our bikes and our e-bikes that are launching. And we think we do pretty well with that with our geofencing bays. And we've got to make sure we continue to do that with the next set of things that might come along.
Yeah, no, it sounds like a really interesting challenge. I mean, you've got this sort of very small footprint, and that's, you know, possibly one of your big selling points for getting into councils is, you know, we're not putting in lots of new street furniture and things like that, but also making it both convenient so that people use these things, but also, you know, expanding that out and stuff. So
Yeah. It's like our Hereford scheme, for example, which is an area where, you know, without this sort of method of operation and this technology underpinning it, it would be very difficult to make a bike share system in Hereford like viable commercially, even with the local authority support that we get. But like we do have that in Hereford, but we also like the service area of that scheme in Hereford, the number of bays that are deployed into Hereford and almost the number of bikes actually makes the Hereford bike share scheme something that's not far off the same size as the Glasgow bike share scheme. And you know, that is able to serve that city so much better. You think of the comparative size of somewhere like Hereford and therefore the number of people that have access to that system compared to the total number of people in somewhere like Glasgow who have access to that system. So, yeah, it is really important thinking about these, like the design of our scheme with regard to how you're actually going to get people using it. Like bike share, shared electric scooters, shared electric bikes are, you know, in one big thing that they also are is a massive sort of gateway drug to more sustainable transport behaviors. And like, that's brilliant for, as far as we're concerned. If someone, and we see this happen now in Bournemouth, we've been operational for nearly a year, and we see it's happened loads of times where people use our bikes a few times and then sort of transition up and buy their own bike, and then they're a cyclist or they're commuter cyclists more regularly and they use that. Like that's great. But if that's going to happen, the bike share system needs to be like a really positive thing. It needs to be comfortable. It needs to be serviceable and it needs to not have loads of people thinking, oh, this is an annoying thing getting in my way.
It's a really interesting point you raise about the differences in the schemes that go into different geographies. Now, something we've absolutely found as a company that's gone into, you know, that's grown out of, you know, an initial geography in Bournemouth. We've built apps for bus companies here, and we've taken that product to different geographies around the UK. No one is the same. Everyone talks about a product being the same and mass producible, mass and scalable, but there are nuances to the way that each geography works in order to get the best out of the application within that particular community. I'm really interested by that point that you raised. You know, in Hereford, I don't know Hereford well, but I'm presuming it's smaller than Glasgow. Are you able to kind of, you know, highlight a couple of the things that might be different in say Glasgow to Hereford, and on the basis that
I mean, so Hereford is a town of about 60,000-70,000 people.
Okay.
Glasgow is probably 10-15 times that size. But in terms of the provision of the bike share system that those towns have, like the Hereford bike share system is not a million miles off the Glasgow bike share system. And we get like great ridership, and we're able to sort of make a noticeable impact actually on a scheme that size in terms of modal shift towards cycling. You're absolutely right. They are completely different places. Like that's potentially where the sort of the comparisons end, because then, you know, Glasgow is a completely different ballgame. Like and every other city, the public transport infrastructure is completely different. And so, you know, the reason why it's interesting working with you guys is basically, I think there's lots of evidence that says bike share systems, and why we're interested in working with you guys more and more is because it's actually just driving people onto the public transport as well, right? So in Hereford, that might be a lesser opportunity than other places to drive people onto public transport because it's a smaller place. But somewhere like Glasgow or somewhere like Bournemouth, which is bigger, like if we're able to give a really excellent digital experience to somebody who is able to walk or cycle to a bus or a train to complete their journey, like we definitely can improve that, you know, real world experience with high quality bikes and high quality public transport and make it more accessible with high quality sort of information and digital experiences. Like people are going to do that rather than drive it. Now, obviously, that isn't the case everywhere. Like you have to have a good public transport system for that to be enabled. And that's what I guess, you know, a lot of your other customers in the bus world, like that's how we can sort of segue into that. But you're right, like locally, it's not just automatically going to happen. We're not just going to be able to flip people over from all of their journeys being on car to being on bike and public transport. Like you have to have two good things in the first place.
It's an interesting idea that a smaller community perhaps takes more ownership of its bike share scheme. I remember seeing some tweets when there was some flooding and some photos you guys were sharing about, I think, the people of Hereford moving bikes out of the water for you.
Exactly.
Which is completely the opposite of all the stories you hear about kind of inner city Manchester or, you know, anywhere where the bikes are being kind of thrown or vandalised or, you know, dumped in canals. Actually, the people of that community were helping. And that was really inspiring to see.
Yeah, that's awesome, isn't it? Yeah, like people for whatever reason think that bikes are automatically going to end up in a river because people want to pick them up and throw them in there. Like, presumably, you know, it does happen. But in that instance, the exact opposite happened. People wanted to proactively go out their way and help us and move the bikes. And yeah, I mean, I'm sure, hopefully, I think, you know, all the bike share systems where we operate, you know, the community, you know, we operate them to a level of sort of quality and we integrate them into the city to a level whereby people, I think, certainly do see them as an asset to the town. Like you guys, you know, would be able to speak to that more than me in Bournemouth and Poole. But I think overall, like people see it as an asset and they see it as a service, which isn't necessarily a foregone conclusion, actually, with some of these sort of shared systems. And it's not necessarily all that easy to just to achieve that straight away. But it's important that that's what you're aiming for, so that people do use them and respect the system.
I think you're right about this idea of designing stuff in a more considered way. And I think the way you guys have got your bay system and the convenience fee around that, I think that encourages the community to you know, respectfully put things back.
Yeah.
You know, in a place where others can access it. And I think that just that whole sort of position that approach you guys have got is, you know, sort of reinforces this idea that we want it to be an asset. We don't want it to be street litter. You know, we don't want all the negativity that comes with it being considered in that way. So I think you guys have got a really strong proposition.
And do you know what's really interesting about the geofencing? So like we design it around like the location and also what the local authority or the transport authority think is best. So actually in BCP, in Bournemouth, Christchurch and Poole, I think actually the local authority there would be very happy for us to do a little bit more of the free floating type model. So have a few more journeys end out of bay than currently do. Whereas other places where we work, like Watford, they don't want any out of bay. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. But the thing that's really, really interesting is how price sensitive people are to where they're going to leave the bike. So In Bournemouth and Poole, we charge people a £2 convenience fee if they park their bike out of the bay. And we get, I think last time I checked, it was about 82% of journeys finish in a bay. So there's somewhere between 15 and 20% of journeys. People are happy to pay that extra bit of convenience and park the bike where they want. The number of journeys that's happening to is perfectly acceptable from our perspective, from the public's perspective and from the local authority's perspective. Like we don't have bikes where people don't want them really. But the thing that's really interesting, in Watford and in Norwich actually, we charge £5 if you park your bike outside of a bay.
Oh, that is a bit steep.
That's quite... yeah. I mean, I was going to say, £2 as a user feels like enough for me to be, you know, to put it back.
Yeah.
You know, I because otherwise I'm starting to think about, well, that was a fairly short journey. If I'm paying £2 to put that back in and the price, you know, the 5p a minute to actually hire the bike in the first place, maybe we're talking sort of, you know, comparative to a cab.
Yeah.
But... you know, it's that kind of...
Exactly.
Yeah, £5, that seems like quite a big jump.
You get the behaviour that you and the local authority want. So in Watford, you know, they and in Norwich, they don't want actually people to finish their journey outside their home or outside the pub. Even if that's a bit more convenient for that person, they just don't want that to happen. And what we see is that jump from £2 to £5, yeah, you're right. It changes the economic of that as an individual journey. And we see, like... It's over 95%. You know, it's basically all journeys in Watford and Norwich are finishing in the bays, and the thing that's really interesting to me there then is that you start to get into the economics of these journeys and how people are thinking about these journeys, and as we look to introduce our electric bikes, you know, operating models around electric bikes, operating models around electric scooters, the control of the pricing is really interesting to be able to basically encourage people to park the thing where you want the thing to get parked, and it's night and day. You know, if we didn't charge any convenience fee, they would be everywhere. But yeah, going up to £5, they're pretty much always exactly where the bays are. And if it's £2, you know, it's not far off; it's somewhere in between. So that's like where people are parking their vehicle. And you do the same sort of maths. It's like, well, what is my premium? What am I willing to pay extra for an electric bike? Because I'm going to go further, it's going to be faster, and you know, it's a more expensive vehicle. So we can definitely charge a little bit more for that. But then operationally as well, maybe we want to charge the right amount of that convenience fee so that people are parking electric bikes in places where it's easy to serve and it's easy to charge the battery. So, you know, it, what would be quite difficult and unsustainable is if an entire city the size of Birmingham or whatever has electric scooters everywhere. Because then what you've got to do as an operator is comb every street within that entire conurbation, at least looking for a scooter at least once a week in order to swap out the battery. Like, that's an incredible amount of operational headache. Whereas if you're doing it around bays, it's easier because you've got a certain amount of bays that you need to go to. Mm-hmm. But then even better, if you can start to differentiate your pricing so that you might be getting people to park their electric scooter in bays where you have on-street charging, or bays where you know you can very easily do the battery swap out mechanism for charging, then all of a sudden, actually, you're getting far closer to a sustainable shared electric micromobility system that is operationally sustainable than, you know, a free floating model that is very difficult to see the economics working for it. So yeah, the interplay from the bays, the bay design, like getting it set up, working with the local authority, getting it right so that people like it and use it, but then using the tools that you have, the pricing and the technology, to actually make it run in a way mm-hmm. that is sustainable and run in a way that people can access it is an important contribution. The other bit that we want to get right with that is, like, we want to like our electric bikes, people should use if they want to use them, of course. And if anything, you should probably be using them for a journey that is closer to something you'd have been otherwise doing by private car. But if you're going a short distance, you know, you should probably, and you're able to and you want to, it's better if you cycle. In some ways, like, it's better for us because it's a cheaper journey to maintain.
Yeah.
It's better for them from a active travel point of view, and it also leaves the e-bikes available for other people. So, you know, you've got to. The same is true of electric cargo bikes at the other end of the spectrum, right? Who knows how much a shared electric cargo bike someone would be willing to pay for to use? Like, no one knows that. Right. It, but what everyone knows is, like, the positive externalities of somebody doing a delivery in an electric cargo bike is massive. Like, if we're able to get somebody to not drive their journey in a car and do it by bike, that's awesome. If we're able to do the same with electric bikes, that's awesome. And there's probably more of those journeys we can convert. In total volume terms, there's less of these journeys where you can take a van off the road and put in a cargo bike. But the impact of being able to do that for every single one of those journeys is massive. Like, it's massive because the van is big and heavy. It's massive because that logistics operation for last mile is extremely difficult and is economically an expensive thing for people to do. But the other thing that's really important to me on that one is, when a van is delivering its thing, you park this 3.5-ton thing, half on the pavement, half on the road, and someone has to pop out the van and deliver the stuff. And then there's this honking great big 3.5-ton piece of metal that's just in everyone's way for a small amount of time, or sometimes a long amount of time. And that is got to be the sort of thing from a livability point of view. Like, this is all just like now a utopian world where we don't have like vans delivering stuff, but like,
this idea of replacing these delivery is probably the biggest one to solve, not the logistics of people, but the logistics of the things that the people want into these urban areas. You're absolutely right. I'm really fascinated by the Pedal Me guys. I'm following that story with great interest. This is kind of, these are delivery guys, they deliver people and they deliver things, and they're using these cargo bikes to do it. And it is incredible what they're doing right now in terms of some of the sort of getting the supplies around to people that perhaps need them the most at this point in time.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to see this stuff unfold.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I use those guys myself. But I mean, even in both Hereford and Norwich, we're using electric cargo bikes, and in Bournemouth, actually, and maybe in Watford. I think in all of our schemes, we use electric cargo bikes to redistribute our bikes and move them around, whether it's our own one or we're working with a pure in Hereford. We work with a company called Pedicargo who do all of our street maintenance on cargo bikes. Cargo bikes are an amazingly powerful tool, and figuring out how we can get more of those going is an interesting part of the mix, I think.
So it sounds to me, I mean just to kind of contextualize, we've got standard bikes, no batteries, in Bournemouth and Poole at the moment, in Christchurch, and we've got electric bikes. I may say we, Beryl, have got electric bikes kind of coming on stream in various places, potentially down here as well soon. But it sounds to me like you're already thinking about how kind of cargo bikes might play a role for you guys as well.
Yeah, and the full mix, right? Electric scooters, part of the mix. Electric cargo bikes, like, they're all things that we can enable. And what we want, we have a cargo bike actually deployed already that people can hire through our app in a closed scheme in London. And we're doing a few more things like that to sort of take that up to the next level, which would be an electric cargo bike. So we actually proposed something like that down in Bournemouth, Poole and Christchurch. So that, that sort of stuff could be happening. But that cargo bike stuff is, in terms of volume, it's going to be lower. Like, there's not enough customers for thousands of cargo bikes in a town right now. But from a volume point of view, I think like the electric scooter stuff is something that's going to be interesting. Like, we definitely don't think there's volume like you've seen in Europe, where you've got thousands and thousands and thousands of electric scooters from 5, even 10 operators in a single town. Like, that's not the sort of work that we want to do, but we can definitely see how electric scooters play a part. Shared electric scooters, I should say. Clearly, electric scooters, a privately owned electric scooter, like, they exist, and the numbers are going up and up and up and up and up. But there's also, I think, there's a shared electric scooter model that I haven't seen many examples of it really sort of working from an economic point of view. But yeah, there's definitely ways that we want to introduce that into our schemes.
So that kind of rolls into a question that I think we'll finish up on. So we just launched an integration with Nextbike in Cardiff, which is similar to you guys, it's similar to the work that we've done with you guys local to us in Bournemouth. And this is happening across the whole of the UK. Lots of, this integration stuff happening with our stuff and with other suppliers as well. And it's actually been promoted as sort of giving control and giving choice to commuters, especially in this current climate where people might not want to get on to buses. So it's an element of choice where they can still use, if they don't necessarily have their own vehicles, a way to get around. And so I guess sort of a two-question prong there. What do you think about that as a choice of way of promoting it? But also, as well as promoting people, how do we convert those car drivers into sort of permanent users of this? And especially, how do you reach the children to make sure that this is just synonymous with their upbringing? This is the thing that they're thinking about, because I don't think I've seen so far, and I could well be wrong, child bikes that are part of bike share scheme or anything like that. So,
well, I think just on the child bit, the challenge that, you know, bike share rental providers have with younger users is not a inability to serve them. It's an insurance thing as much, and a contracting thing as much as anything. Yeah. You know, every time someone rides a bike, they're contracting with us. You know, you're paying us to use our service. That's a contract. In the bounds of that contract, we're able to deliver a certain level of safety and quality, and also insure you to a certain level. And we actually offer insurance to all our riders, and it's a policy that has been used actually. So if a rider of our bikes, even if it's entirely their fault, they've like cycled into the back of a car and damaged a car, like that's our insurance policy. Our insurance policy will pay out to that driver, even if it's the fault of our rider. Like that's like an important level of service that we want to give to our riders. And of course, we're like insuring the rider and the journey itself. Like if they have an accident, we're insuring them and have all of the necessary safety and liability insurances that you require. It gets a little bit more murky when somebody who is not of majority age is, so effectively, according to the laws of this country, like they can't contract with you. If they're a child, yeah, they can't contract with you. And so some of that stuff gets a little bit more murky. Now, we'd still insure that, right? So if you're putting your kid on a bike, like they are still covered by our insurance. So like, don't worry too much about it. But that's why there's sort of a bit of a challenge there. So that, yeah, it's more of a sort of a regulatory thing and an insurance thing, as I say, as much as anything. Yeah. So actually, right, the answer to getting children, the big societal goal there that you're sort of hinting at, you know, there is no substitute for safe, segregated cycling. And that is the way really to have a societal shift towards people being happy to get their child to cycle to school every day, is if they can see that.
Can I just say amen, Phil? Amen.
Yeah. I can't do that. But politically, like that's how it has to happen. And yeah, like you start with the kids and it ingrained into people, right? We don't need to sort of hypothesize about that so much. You can, well, I don't know, we're probably what, like 220 miles as the crow flies from the Netherlands. Like it's doable. You just do it. Yeah. I know that I say that in a simple sentence, but like it doesn't need to be any more complicated than that. If you have the cash and the political will. But yeah, and I think, I guess the other part of your question was more of a massy type question, in terms of, you mentioned the link there in Nextbike and other places that we might want to do some work together on for enabling just a nice, seamless, easy, sustainable, predictable in cost, predictable in service delivery journey like that. And that's obviously the whole sort of mass thing. And I think, I guess I'm not as like, otherwise I'd be running a mass organization like you guys. I don't have as clear, or other people, I don't have as clear a view as exactly like how all of that stuff really benefits and works from a economic model point of view. But clearly, if you're serving people with a bit more information about how they might be able to make that journey, they're more likely to do it. Like you've got to show people it's possible and deliver people what they expect with their journey, which is, you know, predictability and level of quality. You know, that's the baseline that you've got to meet.
I think you're absolutely right. It's got to start with the individual. It's got to start with that seamless, you know, journey. That efficiency of of service, the payment part. So, and then I think the economic models will follow. I think all of those things will come for the right, you know, in the right geography, for the right organizations, as long as the individual, the traveling public, are the center of that user story and that whole.
Exactly. But again, the other problem I guess I see is, like, again, it's like the local differences. So like a standard mass offering from an individual point of view, like every journey is different. And then of course, and every town is different. So I don't understand some of the mass models where it's like, you know, a subscription sort of mass model where you pay £30 a month or whatever, and you get all you can eat bike share, all you can eat buses, and like two or three cab journeys, and maybe, you know, one scooter ride, and like this like mixed bundle, like a shopping basket almost of stuff that you get, because, you know, everyone's actual sort of pattern is quite different. But my bigger problem there with that is, like, if you've got three or four or two or whatever, like, cab journeys in your basket, people are going to take them. Yeah. And actually,
yeah.
And if that's in a basket, and that may not necessarily be a good thing. And especially if, you know, you've built up a mass model, like you've built up this shopping basket, and the commercial models with the service providers means that as a mass operator, you've got to shove a certain amount of volume onto buses, a certain amount of volume onto bikes, a certain amount of volume onto a vehicle. You know, those journeys that get pushed towards a vehicle, you've got to make sure that those journeys are definitely the ones that should happen with a vehicle, and not just because at that particular time of day, it might be cheaper or quicker. You've got to, like, consider, like, all the other sort of factors around that journey that you're trying to facilitate. So it's difficult.
Right. It absolutely is, and I think we could talk about this for quite a long time, and I haven't even been able to get to my favourite question, which I had in my back pocket, which is, where's the weirdest place you found one of your bikes? But maybe we'll come to that another time.
Yeah, I'll have a think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Phil, as Matt says, it's been really good to chat. I'd love to do this again at some point if you're interested. We could probably spend a day chewing the fat over some of this stuff, so let's maybe call it a day.
Yeah, sounds great. Yeah, no, good to chat to you guys. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you ever so much for giving us the time. Really do appreciate you giving up an hour of your day to Skype and chat with us.
No problems, guys. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks very much. Take care.
Thanks a lot, Phil.
As Phil has just said, the power for change lies with local government. We'll be finding out more about that next week when we talk to BCP councillor Dr. Felicity Rice, portfolio holder for environment and climate change. A former doctor with a passion for clean air and sustainable travel, we'll be asking her what the challenges are for local government making these big changes. I hope you'll join us then. If you have any questions for us or for her, you can always get in contact with us via Twitter @makingpassenger. Until next time.